The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about blood infected with DNA. DNA is everywhere in the body, right? Is there some mystery as to how it got there?
Well, Rob, this is actually a very big mystery in medicine. Just to back up a little bit, what happens sometimes is a patient will come to the hospital, they say broken their leg, and they're treated for that broken leg. But a couple of days later, they develop a high fever, their lungs get really inflamed as if they're fighting off a lung infection. Basically, their body's acting like they have this, you know, serious bacterial infection, even though all they have is a broken bone. And doctors have been trying to figure out what's going on. Originally, they thought, well, maybe, you know, somehow by breaking the bone, bacteria got into the bloodstream or something like that. So they've been trying to figure out, well, what exactly is going on here? Why are these patients acting like they have this severe infection when they don't have an infection at all? They couldn't find any bacteria in the bloodstream, which is what you would expect to see if patients are sort of having this response.
And it's DNA in the bloodstream?
And that gets back to DNA. What researchers found in this new study was when they really closely looked at plasma, which is the colorless fluid in which blood cells are suspended, they were finding not bacteria. And they looked at plasma in a bunch of patients that had come into the hospital with, you know, various breaks and other types of injuries that wouldn't necessarily lend themselves to a bacterial infection. When the researchers looked at this plasma, they didn't see bacteria. What they saw was a bunch of mitochondrial DNA. And mitochondria, as you know, Rob, these are the powerhouses of the cell. These are what give cells their energy. And opposed to nuclear DNA, mitochondria actually have their own DNA that actually gets passed down directly from mother to child.
So the body isn't identifying it as its own.
No, somehow what's happening, the researchers think, is when you have an injury, like a severe injury, like a broken bone, it's somehow ripping these cells apart and releasing a lot of this mitochondrial DNA and even these bits and pieces of mitochondria into the bloodstream. And somehow the body's responding to this mitochondrial debris as if it were a bacterial invader. And when the body sort of ramps up its immune response like this, you get symptoms very similar to as if you were having a bacterial infection. You would get high fever and inflammation and other symptoms like that.
So what is it about the mitochondrial DNA that makes the body want to attack it?
Well, this is an interesting theory about mitochondria, that they actually used to be bacteria that millions or even billions of years ago were swallowed up by cells. And instead of infecting the cell, they actually became a part of the cell. So all the mitochondria we have in our cells today may have been bacteria billions of years ago. And because of that, they have a lot of the same chemical markers on their surface that bacteria do. And one of these chemical markers is called formalpeptide, which is a really common marker that neutrophils, which are these immune cells in your body, use to recognize bacterial invaders. So if they're all of a sudden seeing these markers on the mitochondria in the blood, they start attacking it just as if they were going to start attacking bacteria. The body ramps up its immune response and you get the fever and the inflammation and everything you would get if you really had an honest-to-goodness bacterial infection.
So mystery solved.
Mystery solved. But there's still one more mystery, which is what should doctors do when a patient presents with these symptoms? Because you don't want to turn off the immune response if the patient really does have an honest-to-goodness bacterial infection. So researchers say there's important clinical implications for this, and this may lead to a new way to treat this syndrome. But doctors first need to make sure that it's actually the mitochondria that are causing the problem and not really bacteria that are causing the problem.
The current treatment now is what? Antibiotics?
Yeah, you would use antibiotics for bacteria, and you obviously don't want to stop doing that if you do have bacteria in the bloodstream.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking of misplacing blame, this next story is about how global warming, which was once blamed for the extinction of the golden toad, may not actually have been to blame after all.
What was instead?
Well, Rob, according to this new study, what was to blame instead was natural weather variations. And in this particular case, El Nino.
Where did the golden toad live? And why would that make it particularly susceptible to weather variation?
Well, Rob, the golden toad is this very colorful amphibian. You actually can see a cool picture of one on the site. And it lived in the Costa Rican cloud forest of Monteverde. And the toad was last seen in 1989. Before then, it had really flourished in this area. Then all of a sudden, after 1989, it was gone, completely disappeared, completely extinct. And researchers knew that this area seemed to have been experiencing increased warming over the years. You know, as humans have pumped more carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, places like this region of Costa Verde have become hotter and drier. And that particularly, researchers thought that particularly affected this toad because when amphibians in this region get very hot and dry, they can develop a fatal fungal skin disease. And that actually hurt a lot of amphibians in the area, but the golden toad wasn't able to change its habitat as well as some of the other amphibians. So the researchers think that's why it died out. It just wasn't able to adapt to global warming. But there wasn't really any very hard data for this. The problem with this particular forest was that researchers didn't have climate data going back more than about a decade or two. And in order to, you know, be able to blame or not blame something on a condition like global warming, you really have to have long-term temperature data. So in this new study, these researchers did this very painstaking analysis where they took a bunch of core samples from trees in the area, and they actually looked at over 2,000 pieces of wood. And what they were looking at specifically were concentrations of various oxygen isotopes. And these isotopes give clues as the years go on about changes in weather patterns, you know, warm periods, dry periods, wet periods, things like that. And what the researchers were able to do is they were able to create a weather chart for this forest going back over 100 years. And when they did that and they lined it up with trends in global warming and other weather trends, they found that the global warming trends didn't really match up with when the frogs started to become extinct. Instead, they found a very nice correlation with El Nino.
So these are like molecular versions of tree rings?
Something like that.
Is that a very well-established science in terms of understanding temperature variation, things like that?
Well, one critic of the study says that, no, this is actually a fairly new science. So he says that global warming is not off the hook yet, just because the data aren't as strong as they could be. So unlike the medical mystery, this may not be a situation of case closed just yet.
And is there a way to actually separate the two? I mean, global warming from El Nino?
Well, the researchers say they feel like their data does separate the two, but they really caution that warming is warming. So just because this particular extinction may not be due to global warming, warming itself did lead to the extinction. It just wasn't warming related to global warming. And so what they're saying is when global warming is impacting other areas, it can have just as a dramatic effect as what was seen with the golden toad.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from the warm tropics to the cool Arctic, this last story is about what may be one of the very first polar bears that ever existed.
A fossil.
A fossil. And specifically, this is a fossilized jawbone of a polar bear. And it was found in 2004 in Norway's Svalbard archipelago. And what's really interesting about this fossil is, first of all, believe it or not, it's actually very hard to find any fossilized remnants of polar bears. And that's because polar bears, when they die, they tend to get torn apart by their comrades. That scatters their remains everywhere. Also, they're spending a lot of time in their water, and often when they die, they sink to the bottom of the ocean. So scientists have been really hard-pressed to figure out exactly what the history of polar bears are. There's these really wide-ranging estimates of even when polar bears first appeared. Some scientists say they appeared as recently as 50,000 years ago. Others say they've been around for as long as a million years. But because of lack of fossil evidence, it's been really hard to show.
How old is this fossil?
This fossil, based on the layer of sediment that it was found in, is about 120,000 years old. So that's the first clue that at least 120,000 years ago, we had polar bears.
Were scientists able to extract any DNA from this fossil?
Well, that's what they did. They actually drilled into a tooth in the jawbone and were able to extract some mitochondrial DNA. That's something we talked about earlier. And using this DNA, they compared it to mitochondrial DNA from modern polar bears and also from brown bears, which is where polar bears are thought to have evolved from. And what they found was that the DNA matched up very well with modern polar bears, indicating that this jawbone belonged to a polar bear. But they also found some genetic markers indicating that the DNA had some elements of the brown bear in it. And that suggests to the researchers that this was a very early polar bear because it hadn't completely transitioned out of being a brown bear into being a polar bear. It was almost sort of an intermediate form. Although it was more polar bear than brown bear, it's very, very rare to find these sort of transitional forms in the fossil record.
climate-wise, what was going on during this time that might have prompted this evolution of the polar bear?
Well, Rob, around 120,000 years ago, Earth's climate was actually a lot warmer than it is today, especially in this region where this fossil was found. And so it was easier for these nascent polar bears to exist in this region at this time. And what researchers think happened is as the years went by and this region became the much colder region we know today, these early polar bears adapted. They developed their much thicker coats than the brown bears have. They also had other adaptations like shorter ears and longer necks, things that helped them survive better in the cold and also that helped them survive better as hunters in the water than the brown bear would have been. What's really interesting here is that researchers have really found this point in time where all this really began to start happening.
So evidence for the origins of polar bears. Mystery number 3 out of 3 for this week.
We're batting pretty well this week, Rob.
Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about what killed the dinosaurs. There's been a lot of theories floating around, and researchers say they finally have the definitive evidence of what wiped out these ancient beasts. And for physics geeks...
like me.
We've got a story on antimatter. And on the science policy blog, Science Insider, we've got stories about how the Chilean quake last week affected astronomy in that country, and also a new report about what the state of science is in the United Kingdom. So be sure to check out all of these stories on our brand new site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.